Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Ronan Donovan, a wildlife biologist turned photographer. Not just any photographer, mind you, but a National Geographic explorer and visual storyteller whose work will be presented in an exhibition entitled Wolves, Photography by Ronan Donovan, opening Saturday, May 9th at the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art in St. Petersburg. Created by the National Geographic Society and the National Museum of Wildlife Art, this exhibition will present photography and videos of wild wolves living in two very different environments, the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem in the American West and Ellesmere Island in the Canadian Arctic. In notes for the exhibition, Donovan offered this observation, quote, "The way that a culture views wolves can reveal a lot about how a society interacts with their environment. Is there a belief of power over animals, or is there a collective shared landscape? As a visual storyteller, my goal is to portray my subjects in their most authentic way by showing the challenges they face as well as the tender moments between family members," unquote. The same notes go on to suggest that this exhibition is mounted against a backdrop of wolves in North America being increasingly under threat in the wake of more stringent laws, and that humans continue to encroach on land and food resources that these animals need to survive. Clearly a wolf champion, Donovan maintains a fervent hope that his photographs will provide people with a more thorough comprehension of these often misunderstood animals. We'll discuss wolves and the exhibition, which continues at the James through September 7th. Ronan Donovan joins me in a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Coming up later on today's program, I'll talk with H.H. German, the creator of Calico, the first comic book hero dedicated to fighting animal abuse. I've spoken with H.H. periodically since he launched the first Calico series nearly 6 years ago. I really think Talking Animals should spotlight and support the first comic book hero who battles animal abuse, and so that's what we've been doing. H.H. is unveiling a new edition of Calico called Calico Unwanted Men, involving a new vigilante, Pig Bath, who's gunning for very different targets than our prized vigilante who targets those engaging in animal cruelty. More on the new book when I talk with H.H. German later in today's program. Right now, though, let's get into our conversation with Ronan Donovan about his Wolves exhibition opening again this Saturday, May 9th at the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art in St. Pete. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Ronan Donovan, the Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Ronan.
Hey, good morning, Duncan. So good to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals, and congratulations on the exhibition. I really look forward to discussing with you and the animals featured in it, of course. But first, I'd like to address your previous profession as a field biologist, which I would guess, at least, informs your work as a visual storyteller. So maybe we'll even start further back than that to kick things off here. As a kid, how did you feel about animals of all kinds?
Oh, thanks, Duncan. Appreciate you being open to going back in time a bit and understanding more about what has shaped me into this this work that I do now.
For
yeah.
Sure.
Well, yeah, I grew up in rural Vermont, and I was just actually there visiting family, you know, born and raised there. I live in Montana now, but I remember just a few days ago waking up in the valley where I was raised. I was born at home to two parents who were teachers, and they left kind of a suburban life and cleared some land in rural Vermont and raised my brother and I and our dogs and cats and big garden, and they raised us close to the natural world. And so that was very informative and still is very alive in me, is that valley where I was raised in Norwich, Vermont, and just was there catching salamanders and frogs. And oh my gosh, the spotted salamanders, I love seeing them again. They take me back to my childhood instantly and connecting to something that's very old. Salamander is such an old animal in this world. And, I lived the outdoor rural kid life. We walked a mile and a half to the bus stop through the woods and along the brook. And unless it was below zero, we'd get a ride then. But we'd just have these adventures, my brother and I, going back and forth to school every day. And that carried on into, adolescence. And I had some challenges as a kid. I didn't like to be indoors. You could imagine that upbringing is hard to rein in, so to speak, when you're in school and a boy and told to sit still and all I want to do is run wild and be barefoot and catch frogs and salamanders. And ended up, pushing boundaries in schools and getting suspended a lot and getting in trouble and also trying to fit in and impress my peers. And so I started to steal things when I was 13 and ended up having 2 felonies and 4 misdemeanors for theft. And it was all just trying to fit in. You know, I wasn't selling the stuff. It wasn't monetarily motivated. It was all around trying to fit in. You know, and there's this notion, especially with young boys, of we used to have initiations and rites of passage throughout our lives as humans, and that kept societies and individuals whole and in service of something bigger than themselves. And in the modern world, the absence of that, it seems that, especially boys, we self-initiate, which means we kind of create our own brushes with death and danger. And sometimes it's literal and sometimes it's metaphorical, but that was something that I was seeking. Was I wanted to change in my life. I wanted the world to be different around me. And so I sought that out in this way that wasn't ultimately, you know, accepted in that community. And luckily, my parents and some other mentors, they saw the humanness in me and the beauty that all humans have, and they sent me to the wilderness. And I had my own kind of, held rites of passage with an organization. And that was, I had my 14th birthday there in southeastern Oregon. Was there for 2 months, and that changed my life, and that the wilderness brought me back to myself.
Sounds like the wilderness is kind of a theme, though, throughout, really. Being outdoors and exploring the wilderness and animals and whatever animals happen to be there. Do you think, actually looking back, as you think about it now, Ronan, that perhaps being in a rural area cultivated kind of more of a sense of you feeling like I'm going to try to get some attention or try to fit in here, and maybe that's why those crimes were committed and the other things that maybe sent you off to the wilderness in Southeast Oregon?
Yeah, I think that it's a very human thing. You know, I think of inner city teens, I think of gangs, I think of this desire to belong and to be kind of part of a community, a band, a tribe, which is very human. You know, I think of the human animal as something that we in the modern world, and I say that, you know, the last, let's say, few thousand years of trying to separate ourselves and religions telling us that we're different and we're not part of nature. I think that there's still this ingrained animal instinct that we have to be human and to belong to something. And whether it's rural or urban, humans, especially young boys, again, I keep harping on that, but they seem to seek it out no matter what's around them. And in fact, there's an intactness in the young people that are rebelling against schools system and the structures that don't necessarily make us healthier or more whole. They fit into a bigger story around economics and capitalism and work and money. But ultimately, I think the modern world is realizing, at least a part of the modern world is realizing, that we need to actually nurture young people, and we need to actually lead to healthy, whole adults that are in service of, you know, more than themselves or more than career. And I think that being in a rural area, there's still a lot of that intactness, even if it's distant. You know, the people around me helped. If I was in an urban setting, I probably would have gone to a juvenile detention center, but the judge who sentenced me accepted this wilderness therapy program as an option. And, you know, this is a whole theme of my life, and my life's work is around reconnecting myself and those around me, as many people as I can, back to their nature, which is in relationship to the natural world and to a bigger story than just themselves.
Yeah, well, it does seem like wilderness, being outdoors, animals, from the very get-go, and then throughout what you've at least outlined so far, is absolutely a through line and critical, I guess, to kind of what we'll get into in a few moments, I guess, in terms of your work. But I'd be curious to know, after the wilderness therapy in Southeast Oregon there ended, were you then thinking, okay, well, what I do know is I want to be in amongst wilderness, and I want to do something that keeps me in steady contact with animals? Or what were you thinking then as far as the next steps?
Next steps, you know, I looked at my journal from that time when I was at that wilderness therapy program, and it was all about wanting to belong and be closer to my brother and have a better relationship with my parents and have more friends. It was very much this longing to be part of a community. And I had the framework of knowing that I was comfortable and that there was maybe a not conscious, but a sense that the natural world offered that belonging, offered that acceptance. And I, you know, made it through high school, made it through college. I still wanted to belong. I still almost took a job in Boston working for a mutual funds firm out of college because a bunch of my friends were going that route.
Sorry to laugh, but what you've described so far, even I could say that that doesn't seem like a good fit.
It doesn't seem like a good fit, exactly. Yeah. But I was still searching. You know, I certainly didn't have anything figured out. I don't know that I have anything figured out now still, but it was this notion of like, yeah, all these people that I long to continue a relationship with, my friends, of many of them I went to high school with and college with, that I still wanted to be with them, and they were going to the city, and I bought a brown suit and some shoes that gave me blisters, and I walked around Boston to the two interviews and just could not imagine being A, in a city, and B, indoors all the time. And, you know, the rhetoric was, oh, in 10 years, you'll be set up and have a good family and, you know, a good career. And I was offered both jobs in the following months and turned them both down, and just was, there's, you know, this loud, very present part of my body that was just, there's no way that that would work. And I went into the lobster industry in Maine for 7 months right out of college, and I'm grateful to have had that time, that flexibility, you know, to be able to pause from the kind of restless pace of school and career and the idea of what your future holds at that age. I was not ready to understand what that meant. And then I, you know, a friend told me about these, and this is for listeners too, young people out there. A friend told me about an organization called the Student Conservation Association, and they offer trail crew placements where you go to national park or federal land and you work on trails for a month or 3 months in the summer in between school. And then they have internship placements for high school or college. And I was post-college at this point. And there was a series of internships that I applied to. One of them was working with spotted owls in California for a PhD student who was monitoring their nesting success. And that was what I ended up getting that position, and drove out to Yosemite and started this path that I'm on now, continuing from my childhood, which is being immersed in the natural world, learning, and also the interaction between, you know, human, myself, the greater world, as well as the natural world. Exploring that, and science was my entry point into that.
Yeah, it sounds like lobster action in Maine and the spotted owl helping with the research there in California that the PhD student was working on all sound so far, and again, I've only known you 5 minutes, but sound like a much better fit than mutual funds and putting on your brown suit and going to the city and trying to see what happens there.
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, a brown suit, I don't know what I was thinking. Maybe just like earth tone or something. But
well, even if the suit were a different color, I don't think that would have been the best fit for you as you recount this stuff now. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, it was an interesting, you know, so grateful to have that time to pause. You know, I recommend that to young people whenever they're able to now, to, and parents, you know, to offer that to their kids, as much as it seems counter perhaps or hard to say, you know, take a gap year. I think it's becoming more popular in that adolescent world in the United States. It's very popular in Europe, but just to allow for that pause, especially out of college, it's a very intense space to be in, to leave home for 4 years and then to go off and try to figure it out. And there's a negative stigma around, even around coming home during college or after college, to take that pause. You know, there's a sense of what's wrong with me, or a sense of parents that they want to push their kids out into the world quickly, or that that's what they're supposed to do. But gosh, like, hold on to your family, hold on to your kids as long as you can, not in a way of coddling, but in a kindness of, you know, letting them know that they can always belong, they can always come back home. And the absence of that, it pushes people into
I think these career tracks that can really lead to some unhealth, some unwellness in disconnection from themselves and feeling like, oh, I have to do this thing that doesn't actually feel good or right in my body or my mind. And, you know, I had that time to pause, went to California. It was also the time when I picked up a camera for really the first time with intention, was that Spotted Owl project. I bought a film camera on eBay for $400, a couple lenses, and was photographing slide film. This was, you know, would have been 2005 or six out of college, and really just became enamored with documenting what I was seeing in the natural world and photographing both landscapes and wildlife, and had some great mentors out there, you know, Ansel Adams being an inspiration, and his gallery and his work being there, and his mentorship even long after he's passed, but that presence. And then, you know, a good friend, Mike McDonald, who was a Spotted Owl researcher and still lives out there and was really advanced in photography and taught me a lot. And so I just started that path of side by side collecting data, but then collecting art and beauty in the form of images alongside the data.
So even early on, those were sort of parallel pursuits for you, it sounds like.
Yeah, at least out of college, you know, I didn't really have a sense. I'm still barely even accepting the idea that I could be an artist or that what I create is art, because I feel like so much of it is I'm just documenting what's there. You know, I'm not creating a spotted owl or the scene necessarily. I'm just happen to be standing in the right place and manipulating a machine and clicking a button. And, you know, I do think that there's an art form is of course to it. And I'm accepting that that's partially where I'm at. And, you know, I'm wearing a scarf now, which I feel like artists all have to wear scarves, and that's new for me, but it's this
that's
interesting
a signature element, I guess. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that I had this desire to not just collect data, and it wasn't conscious necessarily that I speak to now, this idea that I try to put heartbeats to data points. I try to create emotion and feeling and bring in the sensing body and mind to a science story or to the natural world in a way that, you know, you can do that with data too, but I was drawn very much to both. I was drawn to being out in the natural world and essentially being a kid, being a human in this way of monitoring and catching and watching wildlife and being able to photograph and share it with family and friends, which is really how it started.
Yeah. No, it seems like it makes total sense as a path to where you would be later and where you'd be today, which we'll get into more in a moment. But in case some folks might have joined us a bit late, let me say this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just did tune in, my guest is Ronan Donovan, a National Geographic explorer and visual storyteller whose work will be presented in an exhibition entitled Wolves, Photography by Ronan Donovan, opening May 9th, that's this Saturday, at the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art in St. Petersburg. If you'd like to ask Ronan a question about his exhibition, about his journey that we've just been discussing a little bit, about wolves, about photography, about related topics, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So after you're helping the guy with the Spotted Owls PhD, I guess that was Mike, if I follow this.
Mike was just one of the field assistants like me. Susan Roberts was the woman who was doing the PhD. I wasn't clear on that.
No worries. Gotcha. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so then you picked up the camera at the same time you kind of picked up the gig. And then were you still doing other kinds of research or field biology once the work on the spotted owls had been completed?
Yeah, the spotted owl work was, you know, seasonal. It was maybe 4 months in the summer. I did two summers like that. And then there's also, for listeners, I mentioned the Student Conservation Association for young people looking to intern and find work in the natural world. There's also the Texas A&M has a job board that is for wildlife postings, and it still is the kind of main go-to place where postings are listed for jobs all around the world. But that was the case when I started 20 years ago as well. So just putting that out there for people.
I applied to like 10 different internships around the country and various things. And one of them was Marine Mammal Observer, which was pretty vague, and applied to it and got that job. And what that was and still exists, this job is, I haven't engaged with it for 10 years now, but it was working on seismic survey ships that were mapping deep water seabed to look for oil and gas deposits, and they needed to have observers on board to watch for whales and dolphins and turtles as part of regulation to minimize the impact on those species. And it was an interesting job that, you know, was part of my path and journey, and I'm grateful for it. But it was also hard, at odds with a lot of kind of how I think of the world. It's very industry based and extraction. And, you know, it was pretty intense. Just, you know, take a helicopter out to an oil rig and refuel and then go another 100 miles offshore in the middle Gulf of Mexico or all around Africa. But it brought me to some really wild places, and it paid for a lot of my camera equipment early on when I was still just an enthusiast, and allowed me to spend 3 months in East Africa after doing a job in Mozambique on a ship. And so it was this interesting experience of I'd work for a month or two at a time on a ship, and then I'd take a month or two off and be able to travel and again have this time or this pause from the pace of traditional modern work of 9 to 5 and 2 weeks vacation like it is in the U.S.
Right. So there was kind of always a fundamental sense of wanderlust, it seems like, that was driving you. So even when you had these cool gigs or opportunities, you would take them, and those often would hook into your interest in the wilderness and animals and stuff. But sometimes when they came to an end, then it would give you even more chance to travel and take photos and explore more of the world. Let me, looks like we have a caller here that has a question for you. Let's get them involved. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Ronan Donovan.
Hey, yes, this is your weekly call from one of many listeners who realizes this is the best nature and animal show on the planet. So thank you, Duncan.
Wow. Okay. Well, whatever you're going to say after that is going to be freighted with the significance, I'm sure. But
I hear you. You know, I used to do somewhat what your guest is doing, and it was motivated in part by growing up in Pinellas County and seeing that the trend line for the human species was to create anthropogenic mass extinction and murder everything I love. I always loved the non-human world more than the human world. So I, back when it was film cameras, super heavy, super expensive and hard to use, like the Nikon F8 and stuff, I would travel the world expressly to document the last great places, the last pristine places that humans hadn't ruined, the last animals of a certain species that were being hunted down. I didn't realize at the time that entire ecosystems, such as the Gulf of Mexico, would be destroyed. And I wanted to ask you, like, in seeing all this incredible stuff, and then maybe you've gone back years later and now it's been turned into a tourist resort or a waste dump, how does it feel emotionally to see the beauty of the non-human world, document it, and then watch it be desecrated?
Yeah, such an important and powerful question, and thank you.
Sure. Thanks for your question. Yeah, go ahead, yeah. Ronan, sorry.
Oh, sure, no worries. Yeah, grateful for that, because that is an important reflection. You know, there's a term that's recent in the human experience called, or at least named, eco-grief or eco-anxiety around these experiences, whether it's just reading the environmental news of our time. Oh, there's a little fox in the field that just came out of the hedge.
Why am I not surprised? I think they'd like to get involved in the interview if it's at all possible, so keep waving them over.
Oh, I'd love to invite that little sweet one in. Yeah, there's some sandhill cranes just a minute ago calling. Just a beautiful place in Montana. But this is, I'm also looking out onto a valley, and there's tons of new construction. It's in Bozeman, Montana, where I am now. And, you know, a valley that used to be a huge wetland, and used to be buffalo in this valley, and tons of elk and grizzly bears and wolves. And, you know, those animals aren't allowed in this valley by modern humans. And, you know, to your caller's question, you know, how does it feel? And for a long time, and I still go through waves, you know, there's anger and rage and the question of why is this happening? And I've tried in my adult life to
provide stories, and often it is, like the caller said, you're kind of documenting the decline or documenting the demise of places. And the feeling in my body has been a lot of pain and, you know, body discomfort, you know, back problems and tension. I hold a lot of stress and anxiety in my stomach. And so there's been a huge effort for me in the last, you know, 6 or 7 years to try to untangle some of that. A beautiful book called The Body Keeps the Score that speaks around trauma and how it lives in the human body, whether it's experience that you've had in your life in the past or inherited trauma from your parents or the trauma of the natural world that's happening around us. There's a quote from Aldo Leopold that I'll summarize around, you know, if you have an ecologically attuned mind of the world, you're living in a world of wounds in the modern sense that we are wounding the world. And the reality of that is we're also wounding ourselves. Like, there is this beautiful, animate, living, soulful life around us in that fox that just ran by, in any bird that you see in the world. And of course, Florida is known for just, it's an incredible place for birds. And I'm looking forward to being there this weekend for the migration and seeing the birds that are showing up. And I think that this is the work that I'm interested in now, is around how do, you know, I can't control anybody else in the world, but how do I connect myself to the natural world more? That experience I had with wilderness therapy when I was a teenager, I am still engaged in that in the last few years of my life of going into the wilderness with a group of people that are creating ceremony and song and grief rituals, and then fasting solo on that land for 4 days and rekindling animism, rekindling the animate relationship to the natural world. You know, I come from the science background and evolutionary history, and that has been my gateway back to reconnecting to the natural world as a human animal. And it totally makes sense to me from that evolutionary standpoint that what fed us, nourished us literally and spiritually or communally was our relationship to the natural world as a human animal. I spent a year researching chimpanzees. They have culture, and they have rain dances they do before it rains. They have all of, you know, they have all of these ways of communicating that we don't even understand yet, that keeps them healthy and keeps them not in states of restless anxiety that we see in the modern world. You know, young people and adults are very anxious, and I think that that is because we're disconnected from the natural world, which means inherently we're disconnected from ourselves. And so it's a very important question that the caller asked, is how does it feel? And it's something that I would extend to the rest of the listeners and again invite them back in to animate relationship. There's somebody brought into my life in the last few years, and there's a book called Braiding Sweetgrass that speaks to this too. But every human comes from a lineage of animate relationship to the natural world. There's a, you know, people say indigeneity or natural people. Every human alive today, whether it was thousands of years ago or are currently still in contact to that relationship to the natural world, all of us came from that. And if, which it makes sense to me, if I truly believe in that, then it means that that is a human right to be in relationship to the natural world in a way where we create song and ceremony and sacred places that we hold to be important. And I think that we're still doing that even in this modern fragmentation and disconnect from the natural world. We have places like Yellowstone or national parks or wilderness areas that we set aside. We kind of think of it as recreation still, and people recreate and they love to go to the beach and they love to be in contact to the ocean. That to me is still that animal instinct of being in contact with something that is a bigger story, even if we're not consciously thinking about those places as sacred or thinking that we could create song and ceremony and have our food come from those landscapes, because they still do. We just don't necessarily have that direct relationship. So as the question, just to put a bow on it, for me is in the last, you know, 2 years specifically, I've been trying to understand and rewild myself, you know, starting to forage. I'm surrounded by lomatium, like a biscuit root is a common name for it here in Montana. And there's a root that has sustained people on this land for
tens of thousands of years, and there's wild onions, and it's just this amazing food availability. I started hunting to understand what that relationship is like, and these are ways that we can bring ourselves back in, and doing it in a way that isn't just walking up and digging and popping the root. It's having a conversation, asking permission, offering something, and doing it in a way that all of that is part of the human experience. And I come from no religious background, have been very kind of anti-organized religion in my juvenile way of being like, oh, that sounds bad, and what Christianity or these things have, or that's a story that I have brought on in the world. And now it's, you know, how do we bring back a spiritual relationship to the natural world that is very human?
All right, well, I have some follow-up questions to that. I'm going to steer us back a little bit towards photography and the exhibition before we get too close to the end of our time here. But we do have another call that I'd like to get involved first. So, hi, you're on Talking Animals with Ronan Donovan. Oh, okay, they were holding for a bit. Maybe, maybe they're no longer with us. But feel free to call back, 813-239-9663. And so you mentioned the chimps, and I was kind of going to ask about that anyway, because you already in our conversation mentioned a number of animals and critters of various kinds that you were involved with or interested in or helping study, et cetera. But I noticed, at least on your website, there's really only just two animals. There's chimps and there's wolves. So I'm curious, we'll get into wolves obviously in a moment since that's the exhibition, but what is it about chimps that did or still does speak to you in a certain way that makes them kind of stand out, it sounds like, amongst the various animals that you've been involved with officially or unofficially in terms of studying or being out in the wilderness with?
The experience I had with wild chimps in Uganda in a place called Kibali National Park, it was another one of those formative experiences that sent me on this path that I've been walking. And what that path is this idea of being invited into a wild group of animals, a wild family. This is a research study group of chimps. They'd been habituated for decades before I arrived, which means that you can show up into the forest and follow them day after day, week after week, month after month, every day, and they will go about their business without being affected by you. They'll, you know, take a nap 20 feet away and you can walk around and they're undisturbed and they go about their lives without feeling afraid, which is such a rare opportunity in the modern human experience to feel like you're part of something in the natural world, to feel like you're being invited in. And I had, you know, this powerful experience with a group of male chimps. There were three of them and they were walking along this path in the forest and they were heading to the edge of the forest and they veered off into the bush and I was the only human with them and went into the bush with them, this thick kind of brush, and they were just sitting there and I was confused. They weren't really doing anything, but they were looking out, and eventually I heard a few minutes later the voices of two men that were coming from the village to go to work inside the national park, which is a normal thing for those men to do. And the chimps don't know those men, and so they wanting to hide from them because they have a territoriality similar to humans. There's in-group and out-group. There's a tribalism to their acceptance of each other and of humans. And so I realized as these men were walking by in the path, they had no idea we were there, that I was hiding with chimps from my own kind, that these chimps accepted me for who I was and as I was, and there was this kind of momentary feeling of belonging. And then we walked to the edge of the forest, and the forest ended. There was a strict line where you could have a foot in the forest and a foot in a tea plantation. And I felt this longing to serve these chimps that accepted me for who I was and to tell stories around the challenges between the relationship to humans and chimps. And that was my introduction to National Geographic magazine, was the work that I did with those chimps. I was using photography as a research tool, and I was climbing trees as part of that research to be up high in the trees with the chimps. And those images were my entry point into National Geographic, which set me on, you know, again, this current path that I'm on. So I have a lot of gratitude to the chimps and to the Richard Wrangham, who was the researcher that invited me in, and to, you know, just that experience that I had for that year living in Uganda.
Wow, that sounds amazing, and I could see why that would have a significant impact on you. It sounds like that kind of spun you off into yet another significant direction, which you're now pursuing. This is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Ronan Donovan, whose work is showcased in an exhibition titled Wolves, Photography by Ronan Donovan, opening May 9th to Saturday at the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art in St. Petersburg. Invited to join the conversation, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So I think... Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Ronan Donovan?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, please. It's you.
Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you so much for your guest today. I really, Ronan, I really appreciate hearing what you have to say and your perspective. I really needed to hear those wise, healing words today about animals, and I just thank you so much.
Oh, I so appreciate the recognition of that, and I think it speaks to the longing that we all have to connect and to heal and to, you brought up the idea of wisdom, and I don't know that I have any. I feel like I share what I've learned from other wise beings, whether it be animals or elders that I've engaged with around the world. But we've talked a lot about, evening grow speaks flying over. We've talked a lot about the human experience, and I've talked a lot about my own human experience. And ultimately, I feel like what I am focused on now is that I was healing our relationship to the natural world feels like the most important thing, that, to try to save a place, you have to actually save the humans around it. We think about, and I have and still do, about, we got to save the animals and, bringing wolves back to Yellowstone. I have been all in support of that. And it is also about healing the relationship that humans have the natural world, and wolves suffer because that relationship is broken. There's a lot of wolf hunting and a lot of, there's people that have license plate that say wolf hater in Montana, and they hunt wolves out of hate and spite. And I think that that's, there's an unwellness to that. I don't know that it's healthy to hunt something, to kill something you hate. I kill elk and deer and I eat them, and I certainly don't hate them. I love them and I do my best to honor them each meal and at their death. And it's still, I feel grief in that of taking life. But I think that, we've talked a lot about humans, and that's important because ultimately we are holding this power of dominance over the natural world. And again, it's not necessarily to our long-term benefit as a species to do that, and even our short-term benefit. There's an amazing study that was looking at post-traumatic stress that people experienced in the wars of the early 2000s in the United U.S. soldiers, and they came back and went through traditional means of healing, Native American means of healing. These were Native American indigenous soldiers that went, and they had a 70% improvement rate in their symptoms. And then the contrast was non-tribal members, so, European or other descent in the United States, and they went through talk therapy and maybe some EMDR, like rapid eye movement, and also some medication, and they had maybe a 40% increase in their symptoms and healing. And then they put the non-tribal members through their ceremonial sweats and fasting and song, and they had the same 70% improvement. And what that speaks to is indigenous cultures are in contact with the natural world and the healing ability of the natural world in a way that it benefits all humans, because we all came from that. And for us to just focus on saving a place, if we're not focused on healing the people around it, I don't believe that it will have the long-term outcome of actually saving the place or the species, if that is in fact the goal.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's really a cool, complex response there, Ronan, and a lot to chew on. So sadly, we're kind of nearing the end of our time. So I do want to ask a couple of quick questions if I can about the exhibition, just since that's kind of what ostensibly brought us here today together. Ideally, what kind of reaction would you hope visitors to this exhibition? Again, it's titled Wolves, Photography by Ronan Donovan, and it's opening this Saturday at the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art in St. Pete. What kind of reaction would you hope visitors to this exhibition would come away with? How would you like to see their perception of wolves be changed, for example?
I bring people in with wolves and the kind of mystique and the power that wolves have on the human psyche. They're the first animal we domesticated some 30,000 years ago in Eurasia. We have 90 million dogs, which are wolves, in the United States. And the relationships of us with dogs is so deep. And I'm sure your listeners who have dogs understand that relationship can relate. And so people get drawn in to the name wolves, and then they get to experience in the exhibit two very different modern human relationships to wolves. One in the Yellowstone, which is still unfolding. There's conservation and there's love and there's success and there's also hate and challenge and conflict moving forward with that relationship. And then they get to experience wolves in the Canadian Arctic, which are alive today and now, and there's a modern relationship there in the sense that it's like going back in time where wolves are curious to humans and they want to seek out connection. And my experience with them there is they want to play. They're curious. They try to steal stuff from me to play the game of keep away, which I'm sure many of us have played with wolves or in the form of dogs or with each other. So people, when they experience the exhibit, my hope is that they come away with a curiosity of their story around wolves, that maybe they're scary or fearful, or that they're gonna get you. As a lot of our myths and stories around wolves. But they could come away with something new and different and curious and realize, especially with the Arctic wolf images, that wolves are these wild teachers that are there waiting for us to remember to come back into relationship with them.
Well, that seems like a noble goal, and hopefully realized when people do come to visit the exhibition. So again, we've just about reached the end of our time, but we're speaking with Ronan Donovan. And again, his exhibition opens this Saturday, May 9th. At the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art in St. Pete. And again, it's entitled Wolves, Photography by Ronan Donovan. And Ronan, thank you so much. And again, you can find out more about his and see some of his other work, including some of the chimps work we talked about, on his website, ronandonovan.com. Ronan, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals. I really enjoyed talking with you. And it sounds like it's been quite a journey that continues to this day.
Thank you, Duncan. Yeah, I appreciate you so much having me on and for offering this space to have these conversations, and to the callers that called in. I'll also say that for anyone who's interested in rites of passage for young people or adults, Animus Valley Institute's organization that does that, School of Lost Borders does that, Rites of Passage Journeys does it specifically with young people, books Braiding Sweetgrass or anything by Martine Prechtel or Bill Plotkin or Francis Weller or Robin Wall Kimmerer, please seek out those wise opportunities. But thank you again, Duncan, for this time. Appreciate it.
Thank you again. Take care, Ron. Thanks again.
You too. Bye-bye. Bye.
Coming up later on the program, I'll chat with H.H. Sherman, the creator of Calico, the first comic book hero dedicated to fighting animal abuse. It's an ongoing series, the latest edition of which is Calico Unwanted Men, which apparently involves a vigilante engaging in evil, dark activities opposed to our longtime hero, Vigilante, who remains devoted to combating animal cruelty. More on this when H.H. Sherman joins us later in the show. Right now, though, we're going to step into the comedy corner with a piece that acknowledges this last Saturday we saw the running of the Kentucky Derby, which, of course, also marks the beginning of the Triple Crown season. With that in mind, here's Nate Fridson with part of a piece called Horse Racing on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WNF.
There's science involved in sports now, which is fascinating to me. You know, we have science involved in sports. We have instant replay. We have sports medicine. We have scientists working round the clock trying to invent new steroids to keep kids interested in baseball. There's all sorts of fascinating things happening with science and sports. So, like, I worry about some of our older sports. Like, how are they going to stay relevant in the next century? You know, like horse racing. How is horse racing going to stay relevant? I think the only way is if technology gets so good that eventually we can talk to the horses after the race and do a post-game interview. Because I would watch horse racing if that was part of it. Just after the race, some sideline reporter just like, we're standing here with Haley's Comet. H-Com, great race. Talk to us about your preparation. And the horse is just like, first I just want to give the glory to God. Through him, all things are possible, except having thumbs and driving a car. You know, it's all about preparation. I slept standing up last night. Ate a bag of oats, just, you know. It put me in a position to be successful. That's what Haley's Comet does. Haley's Comet comes to race. Haley's Comet comes to execute. Haley's Comet comes to refer to himself the third person. That's just Haley's Comet being Haley's Comet. You can't stop Haley's Comet from doing Haley's Comet things. And Porter's like, it's fascinating. Talk to us about turn three. That's where you really took control.
That was Nate Fritzen. In today's Comedy Corner was part of a piece called Horse Racing, taken from his album Best Guy So Far. Now it's time to hear from H.H. Sherman, the creator of Calico, the first comic book hero dedicated to fighting animal abuse, but a new addition to the Calico canon. Here's H.H. Sherman back on Talking Animals on WNO. Good morning, H.H.
Good morning, Duncan.
Welcome back to Talking Animals. Great to talk to you once again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much again. We have a new book out.
Yeah, we'll get to that in one sec. But I was just thinking, for those listening today who may be hearing about Calico for the very first time, maybe you could give us a brief overview, starting with what prompted you to create Calico to begin with.
Sure. I'm a former boxer from the Bronx here in New York. And, you know, I've always loved animals, had some encounters early on with people abusing them. And, you know, I married both my passions, the arts, comics, and fighting animal cruelty, and created Sigma Comics back in 2020 during the pandemic. And, you know, it was a passion project that now just continues to grow and grow. And we love it, thanks to people who love animals.
That's great. And how many elements or additions are there in the Calico series at this point, H.H.?
Sure. Well, we have 20 issues of the comic book. And this latest book, Calico Unwanted Men, collects issues 15 to 20. So with the three trade paperback, Calico Street Math, Calico Morality Play, and now Calico Unwanted Men, we have 20 issues.
Wow, that's building up quite a collection there, the Calico collection.
People love Calico, Duncan. They love the guy who goes out there and gets those animal abusers. Everybody loves Calico.
Yeah, it's hard not to respond to that way, as we have from kind of the first moment that we heard about this. So before we get into the new entry to the series, maybe you can describe the kind of reaction Calico has elicited. I know you just said that people love Calico, but whether that's in the comic book world or a comic book convention specifically, or in the animal welfare world, what kind of response has Calico generated over these last few years since you first introduced it?
It's incredible, and it's a great question. So, you know, years ago, you could find comics anywhere, right? You can go to grocery stores, pharmacies, gas stations, anywhere, really. Nowadays, the only two places to really get comics is conventions and comic book shops, right? So in the comic book conventions, the Comic-Cons, we are undisputably the best-selling title because we sell out everywhere we go. We're the only one that really does that on a consistent basis, and that could be confirmed by, you know, all the main showrunners, Repop, Fan Expo, all the big Comic-Cons. And, you know, it's funny, we're doing radio, but if you see the videos of all the people who are interviewed when they purchase our products, it's incredible. If you go to any one of our Kickstarters, we always have a little video of people reacting at the convention, so you could see a tidbit. And it's just dozens of people loving Calico. People just love animals, and they really hate when there's people who abuse them. And this time, for the first time ever, really have a hero for animals, not just people.
And you made reference to Kickstarter, which I was going to bring up, because one notable thing about sort of the Calico series, and correct me if I'm wrong, H.H., is that each step of the way in launching the new book, the new edition, the new part of the series, whatever it might be, there's been a Kickstarter where people can sort of get involved and obviously help support the effort and then be sort of directly participating in the launch of whatever that new edition is.
Absolutely. Crowdfunding is a very intimate way to support a company, especially an indie company that has a mission. And it really ties you closer to the brand, the mission, and, you know, get a lot of great fun perks that you otherwise would not get if you just simply buy a comic on a website or at a trade show, right? So here you can support a crowdfunding campaign, and every time you hit what we call a stretch goal of achievement in the campaign, we're able to open up new perks. Those may be stickers, posters, huge prints, comics, all sorts of great things that we achieve together as a team.
That sounds great, and it is cool to sort of have ownership as the next Calico comes down the pike.
Absolutely. Calico Unwanted Men, right now on Kickstarter. You know, if you do a search on Google, it'll tell you that, you know, the story features the vegan anti-hero, Calico, by the way, the first vegan anti-hero who fights against animal cruelty, is facing off against Pigbath, a vigilante killing police officers in New York City. And it says here that the narrative pits Calico against Pigbath, with the former's focus on animal rights clashing with the latter's violent anti-cop rampage. And we really think Pigbath is sort of a villain and anti-hero of the times. There's a lot of sort of police misconduct and sort of tension between people and the police. And we thought, wow, what a great clash that would be. Two guys that are anti-heroes, one who really dedicates his life to animals and really isn't into people, and another one trying to fight for the people against, you know, authorities that are doing bad things. So I think it's going to be a really big impacting story. People are going to love this one.
Yeah, well, that sounds like this is the first time we've got almost sort of dueling vigilantes, if I understand this correctly.
You got that right. It's a very rare thing happening in comics. It happens with Marvel and DC, with Daredevil and the Punisher. They're two technically vigilantes, but they have an interesting relationship. But this one is it's going to be way more intense because Pigbath is really adamant, just like the Punisher, I guess, against, you know, fighting for his cause. Whereas, you know, Daredevil is sort of a boxer type of guy who's very high ethic. Calico, both of these guys are vigilantes. So it's going to be interesting to have this unfold in the Sigma Comics universe here. People are loving it.
That's great. Well, it sounds really cool. And people can go to sigmacomics.com and find out more about the company. And I guess you could search for the Kickstarter just by putting that in, or putting in Calico Kickstarter.
That's it. You go, just like you said, you go to our website, sigmacomics.com. The first big banner there takes you right to the Kickstarter. So we really appreciate your support. Everybody listening, please, if you're an animal lover, which I know you guys all are, definitely head over to either sigmacomics.com or directly to Kickstarter. Just type in Calico and you'll find it. Thank you so much, Duncan.
All right, HH, good luck, and keep coming. I look forward to talking to you yet the next edition of Calico when that comes down the pike, because I know it's coming.
Absolutely. It's coming soon. We expect it to drop in July, sometime maybe mid-July. In the meantime, I think Hex sent you a preview, so if you can share that with the audience, that would be great, somehow on the website or something. I don't know. However you do it.
All right, we'll give it a try. I think it's in a PDF form, which makes it tricky, but we'll figure it out something, I'm sure.
All right,
HH, thank you so much, man. Good luck. Thanks for all your good work. All right, coming up on WNF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, WNF's brief news recap. Then we should back to music programming, I think, but I couldn't swear that Sam is back. I know she's been on a nice trip. She may be back today, so she'll be holding forth from 1 to 3. If not, some great sub will be doing the honors in her absence, and then that's followed by Nancy C hosting the Wednesday Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m. And all kinds of other great music and entertainment and programming and stuff coming on 88.5 WMNF. So we'll be back next Wednesday, May 13th, with another edition of Talking Animals. Thanks for listening today. And our thanks to Ronan Donovan and to H.H. German for their input today as guests on the show. And we'll keep rolling along here. Stay tuned for the conversation coming up shortly after the scoop here on 88.5 WMNF Tampa. Thanks again.